Mamet from his CD London House Blues with Paul Wertico and Larry Gray. He's performing, the reason I'm playing it is I love Bob Mamet, but he's also performing Saturday at Piano Forte at 1335 South Michigan. Go to Bob Mamet, as in the playwright David Mamet. Bob is David's younger brother. BobMamet.com. I'll play some more and give you some more information later in the show, but I'm thrilled, actually, to have an old friend on, Greg Trotter. Some time ago, said, Rick, I'm leaving the Tribune, where he was a very talented reporter and a very stylish writer.
Thank you.
And I said, what, did you win the lottery? And he goes, no, I'm getting another job. I said, what is it? He says, I'm going to work for the Greater Chicago Food Depository. And all of a sudden I said, oh my God, the Greater Chicago Food Depository is a place I've known for roughly 30 some years. Mm-hmm. So I said, you got to come on. Once you get settled and come on, and he has come on with the executive director and CEO, Kate Mayer, who had a lovely quick drive down here. Kate, thank you so much for coming in. It occurs to me, and has ever occurred to me, that institutions, I don't care if it's Lincoln Park Zoo or a charitable institution, that when some place has been around for 40 years, there is a tendency on the part of the public who has lived here to take it for granted. It kind of exists kind of under the radar. Is that true for you guys, Kate?
It's a really interesting question, and I think this year is a year that we are acknowledging that we're 40, and I say that because it's actually been an anniversary that's wrought with some emotion for us.
I'll bet.
We are an organization that was founded by a group of individuals who firmly believed that in their lifetimes they would be able to end hunger. So the fact that we are now four decades into this work and we still have an enormous need in
an ever-growing need, true?
In every neighborhood in the city and in every suburban community in Cook County, that is in and of itself a really sobering reality. And it's one that has led us to think this is not a celebration. When you often hear of organizations marking a milestone,
well, they're often just touting themselves, and that is not what you're doing at all.
But it's a recognition of the fact that every day across this community there is this amazing response that happens, largely fueled by volunteers.
I know.
And that is something that is worth acknowledging and celebrating.
Greg, when you went to work there, what drew you to the food depository? What was it beyond, I think, some wonderfully, you know, altruistic urge and an interesting job, but also the ability to heighten the profile of this institution? Yes?
Absolutely. So, yeah, when I was at the Tribune, I covered the food industry as a business reporter in that role. Wrote several stories having to do with SNAP benefits, you know, formerly known as food stamps, and various policy debates around the SNAP, around SNAP. And in those stories, I would often call the Greater Chicago Food Depository to get some perspective. And I just always, I just respected the integrity of the organization. I always felt like they were really sticking up for people who are facing hunger, the low-income people in Cook County. And so it just felt very right to me, you know. It felt like a really good opportunity to career-wise, but also to go maybe do a little bit of good.
Yeah. Kate, take me back to you weren't there, certainly, but to the founding of this organization, because those guys are really heroic to me.
They are heroic, and we just recently had the opportunity to meet two of the heroes for the first time, which was just an incredible gift to all of us. And I should note that it was Greg who made that gift possible, using the reporting skills and investigative skills that he no doubt honed at the Tribune.
Also known as
Google.
I don't
know if he honed them. I think in Greg's case, they may have been innate, but he used them there.
He went out and he found two of the six original founders of the Food Depository who we had lost contact with. And they had, soon after the Food Depository was founded, they had moved out of the Chicago area. And as luck would have it, they came back to visit, and we had the opportunity to spend a morning with them, learn a little bit about those early days and what motivated them.
What did motivate them?
Well,
I mean, it could have been as simple as literally seeing a hungry person on the street. I mean, what we used to call homeless.
So in the case of these two, they had met while doing mission work in Central America, and they had come back to Chicago, and they were struck by the fact that after living abroad, doing mission and service in a third world country, they came back to Chicago and saw very similar conditions.
Well, certainly areas in this city, and I've seen it in my entire life here, that you could blindfold someone and take them to certain areas and either convince them that they were in rural Mississippi in the mid-60s or in some third world country.
That's right. And they were scrappy and idealistic and rolled up their sleeves. And
what were their names?
So
what are their names?
The two individuals, Ann Connor and Ed Sunshine, who ended up...
What a great name.
Great names. They ended up... We heard this wonderful story. They fell in love and got married and almost didn't make the honeymoon because they were putting together a resource guide that documented all of the food pantries in the city of Chicago.
My God.
Ed was a Jesuit priest who left the priesthood to marry Anne in 77. And then they were... To give you an idea of some of the characters, a very eclectic mix of
what would have to be at the time. I mean, absolutely. You don't, you know, it's the whole grassroots. Find me someone who starts a movement, a grassroots movement decades ago that is still going on, who is not an interesting character.
Yes.
Well, and it sounds a little bit like the setup for a joke. We had Ann and Ed. We had Father Phil Marquard, who is responsible for a lot of amazing work, not just the Greater Chicago Food Depository, but the many organizations that he had a critical role in the 1970s in starting or furthering. And then, of course, there was Bob Strube, who's still so many people in Chicago know him as the voice on the radio.
Yep.
And, you know, this big, booming, larger-than-life personality down at the Old South
Water Market. At the Water Market, sure.
And then there were two more individuals that we know, Gertrude Snodgrass, who we know not nearly as much about. We know that she was an individual who was really involved in pantries and in faith organizations on the south and west sides of the city. And then Tom O'Connell. And so the six of them found each other sort of by chance.
That's pretty remarkable.
And had their earliest meetings in a basement in a church on the west side of the city and made the decision to start this organization 40 years ago.
And it was sort of based at Bob Strube's produce market, right?
That's right. Our very first home was a donated stall down at the Old South Water Market.
This is a great...
Two full-time employees.
This is a great, great story. We're going to further explore the Greater Chicago Food Depository with my guest, Kate Mayer, the executive director and CEO, and Greg Trotter, my former colleague at the Tribune, and now just long title, Senior Manager, Public Relations and Content.
Right.
But you found the perfect place.
Thank you, sir.
I really believe that. So stay tuned for just a couple minutes. The Nationals are rolling into the South Side, and the Sox are ready with a patriotic display. Fireworks under the lights Monday at 7 on WGN TV. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Have you ever dreamed of going to space? NASA's going to send civilians to the space station, and we're going to talk to the guy who decides who gets to go.
Isn't that lovely?
Unfortunately, no one gets to go to the moon because the president traded it to Mars. Yeah, you guys got a good deal.
The Rogue Con Show with Anna DeVlantis, back tomorrow afternoon on 720 WGN.
Grainberry, Grainberry.
This is Barb Harris for Grainberry Cereals. You may know that Grainberry is known for nutritious whole grains and natural antioxidants. But now, I'd like to tell you about new Grainberry cereals with remarkable onyx. Onyx Black Sorghum was perfected at Texas A&M University. Its health benefits are remarkable, like neutralizing a full range of free radical threats to your body, from the sun's rays to normal digestion and everything in between. Not only more powerful antioxidants, onyx helps control sugar metabolism in your body. It slows down the absorption of sugar into the bloodstream. And Grainberry Onyx has natural fiber grown within the plant itself, so you don't have to borrow fiber as some cereals do. Also, Grainberry Pancake and Waffle, Cookie, Brownie, and Muffin Mixes, all with remarkable Onyx. Time to give your body some real support. Grainberry with Onyx.
Available at your local Jewel.
Grainberry, Grainberry.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit AIGdirect.com.
Do you have a family? Would you like to help make sure they'll be taken care of if anything were to happen to you? If you answered yes, you probably need life insurance. Now, do you think life insurance is expensive? If you answered yes to that too, you definitely need to give AIG Direct a call. We could find you a $250,000 policy for just $14 a month, which means you could save hundreds of dollars a year. Call us now for a free, no-obligation quote. 1-800-400-6213. Since 1995, we've helped millions of people find out if they could save up to 70% on their term life insurance. See how affordably we can help you protect your family. Call AIG Direct now for your free quote. 1-800-400-6213. You could save up to 70%. That's 1-800-400-6213. 1-800-400-6213.
Party of the summer, and it's on sale now. Blackhawks players, coaches, alumni, and fans gather at the Hilton Chicago July 26th through the 28th for the 2019 Blackhawks Convention, presented by Magellan Corporation. There's autograph and photo sessions, Q&A panels, exhibits, interactive games, and much more. Single-day passes and weekend passes with extra benefits are on sale now. Visit ChicagoBlackhawks.com to purchase passes and get more info.
Welcome back. I'm spending this whole hour with Kate and Gray from the Greater Chicago Food Depository, the website of which is chicagosfoodbank.org. We are talking about two of the founders, this lovely couple. He left the priesthood to marry Ann Connor. His name is Ed Sunshine. You just, thanks to Greg Trotter, just re-met these people. They left shortly after founding the organization?
They did. That's they right. left about 2 years after the organization was founded.
All of the founders sharing the philosophy of, come on, you guys, let's do this. We won't be in we won't need to be in business in 20 years. We'll figure out how to feed everybody who doesn't get food. What in God's name did they think coming back and seeing your operation now?
The thing that has always just really humbled me is that these six founders of the organization came from six completely different walks of life. And I think that's always been a critical piece of who we are as an organization, is that we've got people who are committed to volunteering with us because they care a lot about the hunger issue. Obviously, we have people who come and volunteer because they're really worried about the idea of food waste. There are people who are really worried about nutrition and health, and there are all of these different paths.
And people also, I'm just making a guess here, who care about the future of the city well.
That's right. Who think about it as an economic imperative to ensure that the next generation of Chicagoans have healthy, nutritious food. But these were two that we didn't know anything about, and they came into our building, and they were astonished. I mean, they just sort of stood and looked around, and it was emotional. You could tell.
I can imagine.
But I think for the team of current staff at the Food Depository, what was absolutely amazing as we sat and had a couple of hours to understand what they had been thinking about when they founded the organization. In some ways, I felt like we were reclaiming our history and realizing that we had come full circle as an organization. Today, we are so focused and dedicated to thinking about how we advocate and ensure that the nutrition safety net, SNAP, or what sometimes people refer to as food stamps, the WIC program, school breakfast and school lunch for children, all of these critical programs that make sure that people have food to eat. We work so hard to lift our voice and to make sure that those programs are intact. And what we found out was that was really the intent of those founders when the organization was begun 40 years ago.
Were they, I know it was emotional, but were they shocked? I don't know where they, in what kind of circumstances they live now, but there must have been a kind of shock value and a kind of, if not wistfulness, a kind of a slight disappointment that the food problem still exists on such a larger scale than they had imagined.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was all of that. It was, when I reached, they were surprised to hear from me. You know, I just found, so Ed had been teaching at Barry University down in Florida, teaching some classes on Catholicism. And reached out to him and, you know, are you by chance the same Ed Sunshine that founded the Chicago Food Depository?
For you.
You know, if so, give me a call. Sure. I'd love to talk to you. And, you know, he called me and we had this great conversation and I think there was a lot of gratitude on both sides and it was just so cool. I mean, when they came to visit the Food Depository, just seeing it through their eyes, you know, like what this organization has become from what they started it.
It's a combination, I would think, of pride and
yes,
but also some a wistfulness about not stopping hunger.
Yeah, they expressed both, and you know, there was definitely I think we scheduled 1 hour for their meeting, and it went like for 3 hours.
Oh, I'm
it
sure.
was just a big love fest,
sure.
You know. And that's part of what was so great about it is, you know, we knew that they were two of our founders, but we didn't know really anything about them in the intervening years. They didn't know us, but it turns out they're these, you know, really inspiring people that have had these amazing lives. And
will they have any kind of relationship with the Food Depository in the future?
Absolutely.
I don't mean working for them, but in some kind of.
Oh, absolutely. And I will also add, Ed is still a regular weekly volunteer at a food pantry in his community in Florida.
No.
And he's 81.
And he's and so this his while he was surprised to see how big this building and this effort
how
in
big
Chicago is. Our building is big. It's 268,000 square feet. It is a massive distribution
center. It is sort of a food, and I hate to use the word warehouse and distribution. You know, the food isn't stored there for weeks, I don't think.
No, in fact, the food comes in and goes out very quickly. It's also a volunteer engagement center. So a big part of, and I think this is part of what they were really surprised, but frankly, I think really delighted by, was how our overall volunteer effort has grown over the years.
Where did the volunteers come from?
They come.
Do they come from church groups? Do they come from? Are they just individuals?
Yes.
They're people, really. And
yes.
And where else then?
We have about 22,000 individuals who give time. Yes, every year, and they come from churches, synagogues, mosques, alumni groups, service organizations. We have high school students who come down and do service learning. We have girlfriends who come and decide that instead of going on a trip, they're going to come down and have a Saturday together at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. We have families who do birthday parties. We have every imaginable grouping of people, and we have individuals who have come to us because they're looking for a way to give back, and they fall in love with the Greater Chicago Food Depository, and they give back every week, every walk of life.
Where does the food come from?
The food comes also from every imaginable place. About 50% of the food that we get is donated from corporations, retail grocery stores, growers. So,
well, how does a corporation, I mean, where would a corporation have the food?
So,
you mean a food corporation?
So big food companies, it may be that if you have a marketing department that has decided that the yellow boxes of cereal are not going to sell as well as the red boxes of cereal, guess what? You need to pull those yellow boxes off the shelf. What do? You can donate them to a food bank. And so there are food banks all across this country that we are all a part of, this amazing network, the Feeding America Network, that can accept donations of food like that. So that's one way we get food. We also, right now, as we are sitting here, we have four trucks on the road picking up right now from Starbucks, going out and getting food from the stores that as they close. So literally everywhere we can. Retail,
restaurants,
farmers. We do. A lot of times what we'll do with restaurants, Starbucks, we are picking up that food, but sometimes
I really don't. I never thought of Starbucks as a restaurant, but that's another matter.
But you know,
they have a lot of food.
I know. And so here's a great, so that food that gets picked up from Starbucks overnight then gets delivered to homeless shelters before the shelters, before the residents of the shelters wake up in the morning. And
wow.
So around 4:30 in the morning, our vans will show up at shelters all across the city and deliver the food that's been collected overnight. It's a great circle.
That's an amazing thing. Yeah. After we get the news, I'm going to have you sort of detail a day in the life of not just the depository itself, but of the various people you serve, because I know, you know, you've, and also the evolving brand, you know, that is meant, and that's very recent, is it not?
Yeah, a couple
weeks. The evolving brand, it's a new logo, it's a new kind of message, mm-hmm. to, you know, reaffirm to people what you do. So that's how we'll spend that time. Starbucks, good for Starbucks. Not going to make me vote for what's his name for president, but but that good for Starbucks. I am very pleased to know that they give food. Was it hard to get them to do that?
No, they actually came to us. This was an idea that they had tried in other cities.
Fantastic. We'll continue on after a couple minutes of news. Listening to is the album by Bob Mamet, along with Paul Wertico and Larry Gray. London House Blues. Bob and his trio will be performing Saturday at Piano Forte, which is a wonderful place to hear music. 1335 South Michigan Avenue. No booze, which makes it a place you really do have to listen to music. There are wonderful places that serve booze. Piano Forte is not one of them. It's Saturday night, reception about 6:30 and concert at 7. You can go to pianofortechicago.com or, better yet, go to Bob Mamet, MAMET.com, the younger brother of David Mamet. It is my pleasure, my ongoing pleasure, to be talking to Kate Mayer, Executive Director and CEO of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, and Greg Trotter, my former colleague at the Tribune and a good friend, who has a longer title, Senior Manager, Public Relations and Content. We're talking about everything. We talked about some history of it, about its ongoing mission, about the sort of change in the evolving of the brand. I think, and tell me I'm wrong, that when a lot of people think of the Chicago Food Depository, their quick reaction is, well, this is like food for homeless people. It is hard, but don't you, that is the maybe cliche thought. Well, they're feeding homeless people. You are feeding, there's so many more people in need. We don't go, people who live and work where we are at the Tribune facility on Wacker Drive, we don't get to go out to Ashburn and Englewood and Zion and all these other sort of communities where there are no grocery stores, where people, families, the disabled, it's a huge swath of people.
So I think that's, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the biggest changes over the last decade.
Yeah.
Is when we think about who needs the Greater Chicago
Food. Who needs food?
And it's true that when we were founded, and we talked a lot about our history, in the early days, it probably was largely a population of people who were struggling with homelessness.
Sure.
But the world has changed.
Yes.
And increasingly, the story of being hungry in this city, which is a story that is repeated in other cities and communities all across this country, is the story not of being homeless, but of being employed,
being
sometimes
old,
having multiple jobs, of doing everything that you are quote unquote supposed to do. You are working multiple jobs, you're sending your children to school, you're paying your bills, you're being a good neighbor. But when you get to the end of the month, and you have paid those bills, and you've put gas in your car so that you can go to work the next day,
mm-hmm.
you have no money in your bank account, and you have no food in your kitchen pantry.
Yeah.
And increasingly, what we see is this huge population of people who are needing to turn to this network of food pantries and soup kitchens to get by, to make ends meet.
It must also be true of the elderly and people on fixed incomes.
Absolutely.
That thought, well, my retirement's going to take care of everything, and I'll be living in Florida in a really nice house with a swimming pool, and they're eating cat food.
That's right. And I think that's actually one of the untold stories of what happened during the recession. There were so many people who lost their toehold.
Oh.
And they lost their jobs, they lost their house, they lost their savings. And as we've had a recovery, it's a recovery that has not benefited everybody.
No, it's benefited CEOs.
We have so many individuals who have found themselves in a new, deep, deep world of poverty.
Yeah. Greg, as you've been out there, go ahead, say whatever you want.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
That, is there... most people are prideful, and most people, I think, don't like to ask for help. Do you? You must have to break down some barriers in order to reach out the hand and help these people. True.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the other hand, a lot of people just, you know, they appreciate.
Sure.
The human contact, and you know, so part of my job is I go out to food pantries and in shelters and various programs and talk to people and write about it for our website. And
what do you hear from these people?
Well, I mean,
I know you can't generalize, but
yeah, I mean, it just, you know, speaking to the question of who do we serve, I mean, it's been really a kind of a revelation for me to see this the vast range of people that we serve. It's, you know, sure. People experiencing homelessness, mentally ill, but it's also college students, it's also retirees, graduate students I've interviewed in food pantries. And, you know, what we saw with the federal shutdown is that many
exactly.
Americans are one paycheck away, essentially, from having to go to a food pantry.
How do they find you? How does an individual, for instance, if let's say I was a school teacher and I had three kids and I was a single parent and trying to raise these kids and had debts and all sorts of other things. How do I find you?
So the easiest way, and you mentioned our website.
No, but beyond that, if I don't know computers, and I, as a lot of people, especially elderly, don't. How do they learn about you? I mean,
the website, and I recognize that there are certainly people who don't, but one of the reasons the website is such a great resource is it can tell you, if you say, this is where I am, it can tell you where there is a food pantry that's open near you. And so that, what we have is not only that individuals can use that, we have librarians who use that as a resource. We have case managers at human service organizations all over town. We have police officers who use that as a resource. So we have this incredible network of caregivers who know that if they go to that website, chicagosfoodbank.org, they can find find a place where someone can get food today.
What about hospitals? Are hospitals helpful in spreading the word?
Absolutely. And in fact, increasingly, they are a strategic partner.
You would think.
We do a lot of work with hospitals and healthcare organizations because one of the things that we know is that this population of people that we're serving, not only are they stressed from the need for food, but they are struggling with really, really basic diet-related illnesses.
Sure.
The population of people that we see turning to food pantries and soup kitchens are disproportionately affected by diabetes, hypertension, obesity, all things that can be managed with proper diet and access to quality food.
Yeah, because many of these, you know, you've often heard, I guess, and maybe in the last decade, the notion of food desert, meaning basically, in the simplest, stupidest term, no grocery stores around there. But many of those neighborhoods are nothing but fast food operations.
That's right.
And corner stores.
Huh?
Or corner stores.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes the term is food swamp, right? That there's an abundance of food that is inexpensive and not healthy, and very few places where you can actually purchase fresh fruits and vegetables for your family. And that's certainly a challenge.
Well, and sometimes it's you know, the new Whole Foods on the South Side is out of the reach of many men, financially out of the reach of many people.
You know, and that's, you're right. Sometimes it's difficult for families to put food on their table using just being able to go into a grocery store and buy food, which is why the food stamp program, or SNAP, is so critical and why we advocate so strongly. Because the truth of the matter is, for every meal that we are able to provide at the Greater Chicago Food Depository, and we provide millions of them each year, the SNAP program provides 10. It is an enormous safety net for people in need. And yet, it is really under fire right now.
Yeah,
and
no
we need to do a better job of demonstrating that this is a program that works. It catches people when they're falling. It catapults them back into a healthy life. The dollars that people get in SNAP benefits are dollars they spend in their community,
exactly,
at stores, exactly, that hire people in their community. It's an incredible program. It's a government program that works, and we should be celebrating SNAP. And yet, unfortunately, too often people are looking for ways to make the program go away, make it more difficult for people to access SNAP.
Well, you know, it's that whole horrible, to my mind, right wing, get a job. You know, why can't you get a job? I've been hearing that in this town for 50 years. We have to take another little break, and we'll spend this last moment with Kate Mayer and Greg Trotter talking about the future. I mean, about hopes and optimistic. You've made me terribly optimistic about the future. I don't want to say you're both going to be out of a job in 20 years. I wish you would be.
You
could find something else to do. But if you all of a sudden, 20
something
years from now,
title,
if I were around, you'd say, Rick, it's not a problem anymore. Oh, we can't come on the radio show.
We would
show.
Love that.
I would, too. Yes. No, we can't come on. We got new jobs. We're doing something else. We're fighting to save something else. You two have been great. But let's talk a little sort of optimistically again. The website is chicagosfoodbank.org. We will be back in a couple minutes.
If you're moving or know someone who is, that's a hassle. We've got a can't-miss segment with some helpful advice at 1:35.
John Williams, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 720 WGN.
So you're tired of the poor service from the large steamer companies, right? Then let my family show you what clean really looks like. Hi, this is Kelly from Executive Green Carpet Cleaning. We'll clean three rooms for just $139, and your carpets will look amazing. They'll feel softer, look brighter, and dry in half the time. Call 630-990-8600. That's 630-990-8600. Or visit executivegreencarpetcleaning.com. And don't forget to ask about our free spot cleaner.
Paid actor endorsement. Individual rates, coverage offerings, and savings may vary. Subject to terms and conditions. Not available in all areas. Owning a small business means I'm constantly pulled in a dozen directions. Are orders coming in? Are shipments going out? Am I losing business to the competition? So when I started hiring employees, workers' comp insurance was low on my list of things to figure out. I just went with the biggest name provider and crossed my fingers. I had no idea I might be overpaying until a friend recommended Pi Insurance. And just like that, I found out I could save 30%.
Pi Insurance's simple, streamlined online process puts you in control. You can get an online quote in as little as 2 minutes, right from your computer or smartphone. Our workers' comp insurance is A-rated by AM Best and helps protect your business and your employees. And we may be able to save you a bundle.
Saving big money on workers' comp insurance was as easy as pie.
Find out if your small business is overpaying for workers' comp insurance. Get a quote and see how much you can save at pieinsurance.com. That's pieinsurance.com.
Starting a home improvement project can be stressful and challenging. More than 20,000 Chicagoland homeowners have trusted Bill Conforti at Cobblestone Development with all their home improvement projects. Kitchens, baths, windows, siding, and more. Bill and his project managers work with all the professional trades needed to ensure your project is done on time and within budget. With an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, Cobblestone Development offers great design, quality products, and expert installation. And right now, you'll save 20% on all your home improvement projects. That's right, 20%. And we have affordable financing options. Hurry, offer ends soon. Visit cobblestonedevelopment.com or call 773-661-0606. 773-661-0606. Cobblestone Development, Chicagoland's premier home remodeler.
Remodel your home with Cobblestone.
The numbers are in.
WGN Plus is where Chicago comes for podcasts.
Here's what's going on with WGN Plus. Working these days can be quite challenging, but do you think it'd be better having your spouse at work? Single Married Divorce finds out. Sit Down Stand-Ups is back at it again with a comedian musician. No, wait. Musician comedian? Musedian? And Mason Vera Payne sat down with the 2019 North American Breakthrough producer and DJ, Jay Wura. Look them up on WGN Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I have just a brief time left with Kate Mayer and Greg Trotter, both of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, and it's been a revelation for me, really grasping. I kind of know what you guys did. Now I really know what you do, and I admire the efforts even more so.
Thank you.
I suppose the idea is to eventually see a hunger-free community. I cannot be optimistic about that unless there are changes radically across this entire nation. But I have to think the two of you, because I find you both to be optimistic people, do think that might be a possibility. Are we all dreaming or no?
I'm sitting here and I'm looking out the windows of this studio at what I think is the most beautiful city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a city that 40 years ago, this group of individuals came together with an idea. And as improbable as it seemed, they managed to build an organization that today provides food and hope to hundreds of thousands of people every day. And while there are certainly moments that it feels overwhelming, and the reality is that over the last 10 years, we have seen the need skyrocket.
Sure.
And we've seen no sign of it going down. But at the same time that we see this overwhelming need, we also see this overwhelming response. We see people who want to volunteer. We see people who want to hold food drives. We see people who want to be a part of a new narrative, of a solution, and I do think it's possible. This is not a problem of supply chain. We have enough food in this world to feed everyone.
Mm.
This is about will.
Greg, when you, relatively new to the organization, have been out and about seeing that, you must share that kind of optimistic view. I mean, you were on the ground talking to people and writing a newsletter and looking for story ideas for those of us on the other side of the game here.
Yeah.
You must find that on a daily basis.
Absolutely. I mean,
hope.
There's hope and optimism in the people on the front lines who are running these pantries and shelters that are just putting in long hours, and there's so many incredible people out there doing this work, just the unsung heroes of Chicago in many ways. But there's also, I think, within our organizations, hope and optimism, because we're really at a turning point in the organization. 40 years in, we're evolving in different ways. We recently expanded our cold storage capacity at our facility so we can buy and distribute more fresh produce, which is
another thing we were talking about. The depository buys food, too.
Yes.
Not all, you know, donated by Starbucks, God love them, and other places.
About a third of the food that we distribute, we have to purchase. That's right. That's right.
And that's been an increasing focus in recent years under Kate's leadership. In terms of healthy food, healthier, more nutritious food, more fresh produce and fresh proteins, getting away from some of the less healthy food that used to be distributed. So that's part of it. We also recently brightened our volunteer engagement space at the warehouse, so just make it a more welcoming place. And I don't know if you want to take away kind of what may be coming or.
That's right. So we've been busy. So as Greg said, doing some renovations on our existing facility, but we're also planning for a new facility. And you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are still really vulnerable individuals in our community. There are older adults, there are people with disabilities, and we have a vision and a belief that there's more that we can do to make sure that those individuals have meals that they need to be healthy. And so we are committed to significantly expanding our work to make sure that there's no one in Cook County that is going hungry.
So that's right. I mean, by Greater Chicago, you do include the entire
country. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, expanding into meal delivery for older adults and people with disabilities in the years to come. So that's going to be a big organizational shift, and we're excited about it. More job training as well.
That's right. We haven't talked about the fact that a big effort that we have is, it's 20 years old, and I think we sometimes forget to talk about it, but Chicago's Community Kitchens, which is a workforce development program that provides men and women with an opportunity to prepare for a job in the hospitality industry.
Oh, great.
14-week long training program. The stories of the men and women in the program, it's amazing individuals who are lifting themselves out of a cycle of need.
Yeah.
And we are expanding that program as well.
You've changed your kind of slogan, tagline. It is now from hungry to hopeful. I was not at all hungry when I came in this studio, but I am filled with hope. I mean, Greg had told me a little about his new job, but meeting you, Kate, just reaffirms every good reason that he left the paper to go work for you. I mean, this is... And I'm not a very religious guy, but this is the way to go. Has Lori Lightfoot formed a relationship with you guys yet?
She has been in touch. We know that she's got a lot that she has on her docket right now, but she has been in touch.
No kidding.
And we really look forward to working with all of the leaders in our community, all across the community. I think
how has the in the 5 minutes we have left, how has the relationship between the, you know, inherent and sometimes tone-deaf power structure in this city been with the depository? I can't imagine they have turned a deaf ear, but have they been as collaborative and helpful as one would like?
I think we enjoy great relationships across the board, and I think, you know, the thing about what we do, I have met over the
years...
Yeah,
what's the dark side? Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
I have met over the years thousands of people, and they come from every different political persuasion, but I have yet to meet somebody who thinks that it's okay to be hungry in the greatest city in this country.
You know, and the irony, too, is the city has, in these last, not 40 years, but 20 years, when the original founders thought that no one would be hungry, the restaurant scene in this town is just exploded. Yeah. And people have become so much more food savvy. I think much of that having to do with, you know, various chef television shows.
And it's interesting you say that. We have a lot of really good friends in the culinary world
well.
And they are motivated by this idea that they love food. There is a joy in being a chef, in providing an amazing meal or an amazing experience for somebody who comes into your restaurant. And there's a sadness in knowing that there are people who are your neighbors who don't have access to
food. And the other thing about the food and hospitality industry, some of the people you're training through the depository, you know, many of the people working in restaurants, even the leading chefs, are people who from very, these aren't trust fund kids,
right,
for the most part. These are people who worked their way up, and sometimes from very rough circumstances.
Absolutely. And so I think this idea of this joy that we are a great food city, and we can be a great food city for everybody.
Well, the great thing, it would be a great food city if nobody was hungry. Greg Trotter, I cannot thank you enough for I can't thank you enough for leaving the Tribune and doing something doing something like this with your life. I certainly miss you over there. Yeah. But you have found a space that is going to reward you in ways that sometimes a byline can't reward a person.
I appreciate it. I mean, I feel very lucky to go from one institution that I very much believe in to another.
Sure.
I feel very lucky to have made that move. And so, yeah.
And you, Kate Mayer, are the kind of passionate person who needs to be working to help this city. You are the executive director and CEO of the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Greg's title is too long, and I won't mention it anymore, but please go to chicagosfoodbank.org, especially if you're listening to this and you're hungry and you're in need. Then it is essential you go, but also if you want to volunteer and see, it's a great website, and you can figure out ways that you can help. You too, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you're doing for this city, too, because I care deeply, deeply about this place.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. There's going to be commercials, and then there's going to be some news with Roger Badish, and then you are going to meet, through a book, one of the most fascinating yet remarkably unknown Chicagoans. Is Ron, I'm talking to the author over there. That's accurate, right? Thank you. It's his book. He wrote it, so maybe he has to say that. But this guy fascinated me. He will, you too. So stay tuned. That again is Bob Mamet from his great, great CD, London House Blues, with Paul Wertico and Larry Gray. Bob and his trio will be performing Saturday night at Piano Forte, 1335 South Michigan. You can go to pianofortechicago.com or bobmamet.com, or you can just show up there. Show up there at 6:30. Concert starts at 7. It is my real pleasure. This book so caught me off guard. Our mutual friend Ron Vasile is the author of the book, William Stimson and the Golden Age of American Natural History. Our mutual friend Joel Greenberg kind of put us together. Joel had written a fascinating book about passenger pigeons that was another book that also caught me off guard. Ron, welcome to the show. This guy is one of the most you write. Well, it's not me who says it. You say at the in the beginning of the introduction, there are a few 19th century zoologists whose lives were as compelling, colorful, and eventful as that of William Stimson. I would argue there are few people I've read about whose life is compelling, colorful, and eventful as William Stimson.
He's a person that really has not been written about And the way that, that this book came about is I used to work at the Chicago Academy of Sciences.
Which is now the headquarters of the Lincoln Park Zoo, the office building of the Lincoln Park Zoo.
Correct.
Clark and Armitage.
And I was in charge of the collections, and then they also gave me charge of the archives. And I found a notebook of letters written to William Stimson immediately after the Great Chicago Fire.
Had you ever heard of him before?
No. No, just not until I started working at the Academy.
Yeah.
So I found this notebook of letters written to him that were from every major American naturalist commiserating with him over his losses in the fire. And back in those pre-internet days, I started searching for information about this guy, and it turns out there really was very little. And that led me on a 30-year trek to...
Yes, he spent 30 years writing this book, so you must buy this book. It is fascinating for many reasons. We'll get into the Chicago sections of it later. But he was, you write in the book too, you write that he was fortunate to live during what had been dubbed the Second Great Age of Discovery. Forgive my ignorance, I don't know what the First Great Age of Discovery was.
Well, the First Great Age of Discovery would have been just the discovery of the New World.
Oh, okay, Columbus,
and
sure.
All the voyages of exploration. And the Second Great Area of Discovery was really more about discovering new species. So this was a time period, the 19th century, where there were all sorts of exploring expeditions going around the world, trying to document all the animals and plants of the world. That was like a goal.
He was, in a way, very lucky to have been born in Boston. He lived in Cambridge, but it near the sea, and to be the son of rather well-to-do parents. I mean, this was a huge, you know, I'm not sure who got into the scientific field in the 1830s or 40s, but you had to have some kind of means, did you not?
Well, his father was actually initially opposed to William's going into a career as a naturalist, because his father was a stove manufacturer, William was the oldest son, and he wanted him to take over the business. And William was fascinated by the ocean and fascinated by all the animals there. And so his father actually discouraged him from doing this, and he had to kind of go against his dad in order to pursue this career.
Would at the time, and I have to think at the time, that parents literally would have thought that their children were nuts or something to, you know, it did not seem like a logical kind of career path.
It seemed like a hobby. And that's how many people viewed natural history back then, was something you do in your spare time, but there was very few jobs available.
At what? So he certainly studied, and he fell under the mentorship of another fascinating. This may be your next book. I don't want to take 30 years again, but this may be your next book. Who was that guy?
So Louis Agassiz was probably the most charismatic, most well-known naturalist in America. Came over from Switzerland and settled there in Cambridge at Harvard. And Stimson studied under him. He never officially enrolled at the university. And Agassiz kind of took him on as a special student, mentored him for a couple of years, and really gave Stimson a really good foundation in the basics of marine biology.
Well, I guess he must have recognized in Stimson a like-minded passion for something that was not a passion you found, you know, wide display.
No, all the great naturalists had that same passion. They simply loved the natural world, they loved the animals, and they wanted to go out in nature and study and see them there.
You write here, too, and I must tell you, for a, you know, it's not an academic book. It's it deals with scientific issues, but you write, for many a New England lad in the 19th century, the sea served as a source of recreation and eventually livelihood, you know, fishing, all that stuff. In the mid-1840s, one young man began taking a rowboat into the waters in and around the harbor. Over the next 20 years, William Stimson would come to know the ocean's inhabitants in a way few ever would. And that's a strong, wonderful statement. He traveled, I mean, necessarily, before coming to Chicago, he traveled a lot. I mean, he wanted to see more.
So his biggest travel that really made a name for him as a naturalist was the U.S. North Pacific Exploring Expedition. So this Just give you a little background. This was the second age of exploration. The United States was sending out expeditions along with other countries. And Stimson was named the chief zoologist at the age of 20.
How?
Because of his connections with Agassiz.
Wow.
And so he actually had to get his father's permission.
He must have also presented well. I mean, he must have been a sort of gentlemanly kind of character.
Yes. Yeah. Good background.
Good breeding.
You know, wealthy
yeah.
family. And so this expedition was in part to map the North Pacific Ocean. The whaling industry wow. was one of the largest industries in America at the time, and they did not have very good charts of the oceans. A lot of whaling ships were lost. And so this was a three-year government expedition. I like to think of it as the most important exploring expedition that no one has ever heard of, because
yeah.
no one's ever written a book about this either.
Why is this? You know, it always intrigues me how people and events get buried by history's dust. Why do you surmise this happened?
Well, being a historian, you realize that there's an awful lot of really famous people in their day that the stories just vanish. And part of it with him is they never did publish a report of that North Pacific exploring expedition. Stimson was working on it, got interrupted by the Civil War, and then all of the papers and articles and specimens were later destroyed in the Great Chicago Fire.
Well, and one thing, he was not did not seem like a big deal self-promoter. I'm going to read you folks one paragraph from early on in the book, the chapter, The First American Naturalist in Japan. You write here, and tell me this isn't the stuff of some like Robert Louis Stevenson thing. One incident marred Stimson's relations with the natives, an episode that he failed to mention in his journal. An inebriated native tried to give Stimson a hug, only to be rebuffed. In anger, he shoved Stimson to the ground, and the furious naturalist wanted the enlisted men accompanying him to shoot the man. That's pretty... But now, if he didn't write about it in his own journals, how did you, the researcher, find that? Where did you find that fascinating tidbit?
So most of the officers on this expedition had to keep a journal. That was part of what they were doing. And the commanding officer then at the end would take all those journals and write the report. So going through the National Archives, I spent a lot of time. This book is mainly assembled from primary sources.
Sure.
Things that happened at the time. Letters, newspapers, diaries. And so there's a lot of documentation in the National Archives to help bring the story to light.
Yeah, that's one of the things that distinguishes the book and why I said it took me greatly by surprise, because of Joel Greenberg and his recommendation. I was going to read the whole thing, but I devoured it. We got to take a little commercial break, and we will continue on talking about this William Stimson and the Golden Age of American Natural History. He's a very compelling-looking guy. Ron Vasile's wife thinks he looks like Art Carney on the cover shot. I think he looks like H.H. Holmes or something. He terrifies me. Well, if you think of scientists as dull, boring figures, you must run out and get or order online William Stimson and the Golden Age of American Natural History. It's published by Northern Illinois University Press. It is written by Ron Vasile, V-A-S-I-L-E, and it contains this about the scientist. I love this. From a letter, the references to alcohol are typical of Stimson's letters of the period. Nearly all the club members drank, and Stimson seems to have consumed more than his share. You give, for a guy, you know, you didn't have a lot of newspaper clippings, you didn't have, you know, documentary film, you really, in 30 years, you bring him to life, to me, and you also bring Chicago to life. He had a, coming back from that journey in his first sort of, not job, but his first prominent place was at the Smithsonian, where he was instrumental in laying the foundation of that amazing place, wasn't he?
So he came back from that North Pacific expedition really starved for scientific companionship.
Yeah.
He actually compared life on board ship to like a being in prison, because a lot of the...
I'm sure it was.
A lot of the officers had no respect for what he was doing. They did not like him. because he was so young. And so they gave him a hard time. So when he came back to Washington, that's where all the specimens were sent. And he rented a house and basically started renting rooms to other naturalists.
Wow.
Because the Smithsonian in Washington was a kind of a central point for bringing in collections. And so he started renting rooms to people and formed what was called the Megatherium Club.
Where they did some drinking.
Where it was basically a club where they get together and drink and eat after the long day's work. They would go out and chase women. They talk about going to all the different...
Wait a minute. Scientists chase women? That's unbelievable to me. I'm joking.
And later on, this club actually lived at the Smithsonian during the Civil War.
Wow.
So the head of the Smithsonian also lived in the building, and he had three young daughters. And Stimson was definitely chasing after a couple of them. We know this from his letters that he was writing to his friends. So... It was almost like an Animal House type thing.
It sounds like it.
The neighbors would complain about them because they were drinking and singing and having a good time. So, yes, naturalists are not just this very staid kind
Who
of...
Who knew? You do such a nice job of... and again, we'll go back to the beginning where the reason Ron Vasile got to know this guy is he was the... among the founding fathers of the Chicago Academy of Sciences, where Ron worked for some years with our mutual friend Joel Greenberg, that is now, it's at the foot of Armitage in the park. It's now the main offices of Lincoln Park Zoo. You do a wonderful job, Mr. Vasile, of capturing Chicago. I've read a lot of books about Chicago.
Thank you.
You also write in here... known today for its world-class museums, in 1867, Chicago had nothing remotely worthy of the term. When people heard the word museum, they probably thought of Colonel Woods' museum, which was, describe it to me.
It was like a P.T. Barnum. They did theatrical productions, they did comedy, he had some specimens, he had live animals, they would bring in elephants. So that's what people thought of in Chicago as a museum before the Chicago Academy of Sciences.
And when he began this, how was he able to do it? I mean, was it force of will? I mean, he certainly was smart.
Well, actually, Chicago, there were a number of Midwestern Academy of Sciences. 1840s and 50s, there was this movement where people were becoming interested in organizing together for science. And Chicago was the only one to provide enough funding for a full-time scientist. And that was because there were a small group of philanthropists who put up the money for this Academy of Sciences.
Yeah. Where was it initially?
The building, the quote-unquote fireproof building, was at Wabash near Van Buren, so right downtown.
And it was a going concern. One of and he was charged with filling the plan. He was in charge of displaying and filling and... what would it have been like to walk in there in 1871?
Well, the goal initially was to gather up as many specimens as possible to try to get the people of Chicago interested in natural history, to support this organization. And, there were some real challenges with that because Chicago was very much focused on money, money, money.
Oh.
Later on, it's going to be called Hustler Town. Well, it started out that way as well.
Nothing's changed, sadly.
And there are also so many immigrants in Chicago in 1870. So it was a challenge trying to get people to come and support the museum. They had mastodon skeletons. They had collections really from all over the world on display.
Wow. And then, of course, October 8th, 1871, there is a fire that not only destroys the building, but destroys virtually all of these specimens that he had put in the building. You do it. It's tragic in your book. I mean, I find it.
Everyone's supposed to cry at the end. Yes.
Well, then they can go back to where he was getting loaded at his private club. You can balance the fun with the joy. There's something I think sad about it because you realize the thing that's sad is you realize, okay, wait a minute, this guy's only in his late 30s, so maybe he will. Resurrect this, go on another trip, do all sorts of stuff. Then he dies, which sort of ices the tragedy for me. What did he die of?
died of tuberculosis, the leading cause of death in the 19th century.
And he died back on the East Coast.
So what happened was the fire, they had the entire Smithsonian collection of marine invertebrates were loaned to him. The Illinois State Collection of Museums were loaned to the Academy because they had this quote-unquote fireproof building, which opened in January of 1868. And so he was telling everyone, you know, you can loan things here and you can store things here. They'll be perfectly safe from fire.
God.
And he actually lost from three fires in his life. There was a fire at the Smithsonian where he lost specimens. There was a fire at the original Academy in 1866 where they lost about half the specimens, and they lost everything in the Great Chicago Fire.
He must have been, I mean, you almost think, I know it was tuberculosis, but you almost think he could have died of a broken heart.
And that's what some of the contemporary accounts talk about. So not only were all those specimens there, but he had a series of unpublished manuscripts that, you know, back in the days before there were copy machines, literally three manuscripts that would have made him famous. And they were all completely incinerated. So not only the specimens that those manuscripts were based on, but the manuscripts themselves.
Ron, this is really a remarkable book. You know, you're a teacher now of history, U.S. history and anthropology at Lockport Township High School. And I know it took 30 years, and that may be why your wife thinks this guy looks like Art Carney, and I think he looks... She's probably been living with... Probably seen this picture.
My wife, the book is dedicated to her.
I saw that.
If not for her, you know, helping take care of the kids. So thank you, Jennifer.
It's tough. Jennifer, it's tough to be the wife of an author, but you can be very proud of your husband. The book, again, is William Stimson and the Golden Age of American Natural History. It is a real Chicago book, too, believe me. Ron Vasile, the last name is V-A-S-I-L-E. It is a pleasure to know you, Ron, and I want to thank Joel Greenberg for hooking us up, as they say.
Thank you for having me.
And maybe I can massage. I'll figure out some way to get a story in about this guy. This guy just fascinates me. And also, he was married. He had a kid.
He had three children.
I mean, the guy did it. He's someone who people should know about. He really should.
I agree. Thank you.
He's an important figure in Chicago history, too. Thank you. Safe drive home.
Thanks.
We'll teach you to stop smoking after the news. Day afternoons on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN radio on TuneIn. It is 10:30 on the dot. And here with the news brought to you by Penny Mustard Furnishings is... Roger Badish.
That's good enough for now. Thanks, Rick. Chicago police officer be charged with driving under the influence after the car he was driving crashed through a storefront, killing one person, seriously wounding a second. Officer was off duty at the time of the accident. Claims he had to swerve to keep from hitting another car that had turned in front of him. Two police officers on the way to a call of a person shot were injured when they collided with a dump truck in the Humboldt Park neighborhood. Happened at the intersection of California and Chicago. Officers are in the hospital with serious head injuries, but they have been stabilized. Video cameras at the intersection show the truck driver did not yield to the police car. House Democrats have scheduled a series of hearings this coming week on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. They're hoping the hearings will eventually lead to an appearance from Mueller. We'll check sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
That again, ladies and gentlemen, is the London House Blues. Bob Mammon on piano along with Paul Wertico and Larry Gray. The Mammon Trio will be performing Saturday at Piano Forte, which is at 1335 South Michigan Avenue. Go to bobmammoth.com. Yes, he is David Mammoth, famous playwright's younger brother. And... or Piano Forte, F-O-R-T-E, Chicago.com to get tickets. It's next Saturday. I think there's a wine thing at 6:30, and the concert starts at 7. My friend Carol Southard, who is on the telephone, is not only a voice in the wilderness, but doing the right thing. She has been helping people stop smoking for a very, very long time. you're not a crusader, Carol, but you are kind of a voice in the wilderness. I mean, there are so few people like you doing what you do, right?
That is correct. I think I'm the only person now in the whole Chicago area doing a hospital-based smoking cessation program. It's become a very lonely field, I'm sorry to say. But yes, I'm still at it, 34 years in May.
Why do you think, you and I have known each other for quite some time, and you've helped
we
me.
We have.
I think you've helped me smoke three times and finally succeeded. That's one of the things I want to talk about too. There's this horrible, you know, people are afraid that if they try to stop smoking and they fail, that they should be ashamed of themselves. And you've told me over the years that almost, I mean, some people can just stop. But most people stop 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, don't they?
Well, the average smoker takes 11 serious attempts over a span of 19 years before permanent quitting is achieved. And that breaks my heart. We could lessen that effort if cessation treatment was promoted instead of shaming, guilting, scaring. None of those tactics work. The tobacco companies know that. They're not worried at all. They're still making plenty of profit. And then there's the combination of the fact that this has become a moral issue instead of the medical issue it is. Smokers, in the main, are ashamed and feel embarrassed and do feel like failures, and they shouldn't. What they should focus on, at least my approach, is you have a chronic disease, in this case nicotine addiction, through no fault of your own. If you had any other chronic disease, you'd get treatment. And if there's one message I could give to smokers out there or any tobacco user, is don't be ashamed, reach out for help. You will be able to quit even if you don't want to. And that's the other important message, as you have heard me say
often.
It's more important to decide to quit and learn how than it is to want to quit.
Why do you think, and it has always confounded me, why do you think that it cannot be that that hospitals are sort of, why doesn't every hospital have a cessation program?
Well, I'll tell you why, and I have become very cynical doing this for so long.
Deservedly so, seriously.
But I'm not giving up. In this country, because our healthcare system is profit-based, profit-driven, it costs the hospitals very little to provide prevention of any kind. But prevention, and again, this is going to sound cynical and horrible, but prevention stops what we do in this country best, which is treat disease. We focus on disease rather than focus on prevention, because that's where the profit is. And I'm not putting anyone down. It's just that it's become so frustrating to me. This is still the most preventable cause of injury and death, bar none. And it gets no attention anymore. And I really think it's because it's become an issue for the most disenfranchised of our society. So more smokers are low income, low educated, people with psychiatric illnesses, the LGBTQ community, and those communities are shoved aside. So what I hear, I cannot tell you how many times I hear, oh, well, what's the big deal? We solved this problem. Nobody's smoking anymore. That's exactly what the tobacco companies want people to think. People, 1 in 5 people in this country still smoke. And if you live below the poverty line, it's 1 in 3. If you have a psychiatric illness, it's 1 in 3. If you have an LGBTQ community, it's 1 in 2.
Wow.
So, we haven't solved the problem. We've shoved it aside. And here's the other thing. It's harder to quit now than ever before. It's always been the most difficult addiction of all to control. It's harder to get off tobacco products than heroin, cocaine, or alcohol.
Why is that? Are tobacco companies enhancing the addictive? Well, no, you don't have to laugh. I mean, you're the expert here. They're enhancing the addictive qualities of tobacco.
Course. Yeah, that's the other thing. And this is, I'm more than cynical about this. I'm angry. I'm outraged. The tobacco companies are supposedly a regulated industry since 2012. I don't know what took so long. But the only thing they're not allowed to do anymore is advertise on TV, right? So what they're doing is they're putting more and more nicotine in the product than ever before. And because, ironically, nicotine is what people are addicted to. It's not what does the damage, except to very young brains. it's what people are addicted to. So it's also very irritating. Well, the tobacco companies don't want to irritate their customers as they're killing them. So the more nicotine they put in, the more products they put in. The cigarette has never been more addictive, and it's never been more dangerous. Wow. And they get away with it. Nobody's stopping them.
That's tragic. What about all of these, you know, when you go into a drugstore, there is a wall, if not a whole aisle, of smoking, things to help you stop smoking, and these electronic cigarettes that I think look idiotic. I think they look crazy. And some are like as big as a, you know, Irv cups in its old cigars or something. What about that? There seems to have been, certainly since we've known each other, a huge growth in the, hey, we can help you stop smoking world.
Well, that's because...
Except effective
also,
people like you, yeah.
Oh, I will tell you that, in full disclosure, there are many people in my profession throughout the country, and especially in England, that advocate use of these products because they are harm reduction. Now, I didn't become a nurse to do harm reduction. I became a nurse to treat in the most efficacious and safe way. And to me, this just reinforces what I've been saying my whole career. We treat smokers like second-class citizens.
Yeah.
Would it be sanctioned to give an alcoholic a drink that has less amount of alcohol than they usually drink? No.
That's a good point. Instead of a bourbon on the rocks, here, have a bourbon and water. This would be better for you.
It's crazy, right? But
yeah.
The tobacco companies, I'm having deja vu with this. I'm watching how they're marketing these electronic cigarettes, the vaping, it's all the same thing. And they own many of these companies, including Juul, the product Juul, which is very popular among adolescents. They are marketing these products as less dangerous. Maybe tobacco users can quit with them. There's never been a study, a credible study, showing that they are successful in helping people quit, ever.
Yeah.
Now, have I had clients who try them? Of course, because they've become trendy.
Well, it's good marketing. I mean, it's some kind of marketing thing. And you think, the marketing has fooled. I know a number of people who are like, hey, I don't smoke anymore. I go, what are these weird things you're shoving in your mouth all the time? It's very strange. What about... Yeah. Well, let's take a break, Carol. Can you stand for a few more minutes and keep talking? And we haven't gotten to the new session begins Tuesday at Swedish Covenant Hospital.
Thank you.
We'll give all the details about that. So hold on for a couple minutes, and we'll continue this, what I ever have found with you, dear, a fascinating conversation. Once again, Bob Mamet and his trio will be performing Saturday night at Piano Forte, which is a great, great listening room at 1335 South Michigan Avenue. Go to Bob Mamet, MAMET.com, and enjoy. Carol Southard's on the phone. On Tuesday, she will begin at Swedish Covenant Hospital in the Anderson Pavilion. Her latest smoking cessation program. What you do there, Carol, is you do not do the typical, you know, oh, here's a picture of what lungs look like.
Never. Never.
Never. You don't
never.
You don't do that. You don't guilt trip people. You do.
Never.
It's a very thoughtful step-by-step plan on how to quit with a variety of you know, nutrition and exercise stuff, stress management strategies, you know, follow-up phone calls. You're always available, too. And you'll be pleased to know that your old client, Tony Fitzpatrick, doesn't smoke anymore, but it took a heart attack to stop him.
I know, but I did. I'm thrilled that he's quit.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled you're quit.
Yeah.
I mean, people always ask me, how do I account for my success rate? Because I have a greater than 50% success rate a year post-treatment, and I track everybody for a year.
Sure.
And really, I don't do anything magic. What I do is what the evidence says is the best way to help people quit. So what you said is absolutely correct. I never try and scare anyone or guilt anyone into quitting. I focus on the treatments that work best for most people. So I'm a huge advocate of the medications, but if someone doesn't want to use a medication, I would never force
it. You mean things like Chantix or...
Chantix, yes. If I could put everyone on Chantix, I would, who uses tobacco. It's a brilliant drug, but there were scare tactics probably promulgated by the tobacco companies.
Well, oh my God, I forgot. The scare tactics were if you take Chantix and stop smoking, you're yes. going to commit suicide.
Yes.
Right.
Suicidal ideation, increased depression. And just if people would step aside and think about what is more risky than smoking a cigarette? Nothing. Not taking a pill. Not
jumping out of a window
on.
Or something. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Okay. Yeah. That might be more immediate.
Well, yes.
But you know what I mean? It's that the scare tactics word and work. And I always find it ironic that people are smoking but afraid to use a medication. And most of these cessation medications have been around for a long, long time. Not that there's that many of them, but the ones that are most efficacious, Chantix is by far the most efficacious. And then there's a mild antidepressant under the generic name is bupropion. They are effective. And the advantage of working with someone like me, who's an expert in the field,
right.
can talk about what might help you the most. And if you don't like it, we'll work on something else. But again, I want to stress that I don't force medication on anybody. I just want people to make an educated decision about whether or not they're going to use medications rather than not use them out of fear.
Yeah.
And I also want to say that I have to give a shout out to Swedish Covenant because Dr. Michael Schau, who's a vascular surgeon there, was instrumental in getting my program at Swedish.
That's great.
Not only that, it's supported by the foundation there. If someone cannot afford the cost, the foundation will allow for a very generous discount. I mean, it's by far the most. I've worked mainly at three hospitals in the city, and this hospital, I have to tell you, it's a small community hospital, but it really seems to care about the community that in which it's placed because it has amazing programs. And to have a program like this, so supported by the physicians, so supported by the foundation there, so cost should never be a barrier to this program.
Yeah, and the cost is relatively minimal. I mean,
it
this
really
is for
eight
1-hour sessions.
Correct.
And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, Carol Southard will be your friend and your mentor and your scout leader for as long as you live after you get to meet her. She's a delightful person. But this is, it's $150 for eight weeks.
Yeah,
8 weeks. And figure, I don't know what a carton of cigarettes costs anymore. I'll tell you that.
Well,
but
you know what? They're about 16. We're higher than New York City now. So they're $16 a pack.
Well, and they're going, aren't they going up?
Go
I mean,
up.
It,
yeah.
that tax thing,
yeah.
yeah, they'll go up.
Yeah.
They'll go up.
For sure.
You still get such a, I don't know if it's pleasure, Carol, or you get a lot out of this when you.
Oh, absolutely. I get rewards every day. I mean, I don't want to sound, overly dramatic, but almost every day I get an email or a voicemail from someone I haven't seen in 20 years. I just want to tell you, you helped me. And so this is not the most lucrative profession I could have chosen, but it's definitely the most rewarding profession.
What about the patch, that kind of thing? I see those all over the place.
Well, they're underutilized, but there's 5 nicotine replacement therapy products. The 3 of them, which are over-the-counter, are the patch. That's the most popular. It's the easiest. You put it on, change it every 24 hours. And then there's nicotine gum, and then there's the nicotine lozenge. And then
right.
there's 2 by prescription, which most people don't know about. And how insane is that? You need a prescription to get nicotine products.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
But
you can go out and buy cigarettes, which have over 9,000 chemicals in them. I mean, it's crazy,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But so that's the kind of thing I educate about. What's available and how to use them. And then the both the bupropion and Chantix are by prescription only, but again, thanks to the support from Dr. Schau, I'm able to call in prescriptions for folks so they don't need to wait to get to their doctor. You know, they can start it right away.
Sure.
I also want to stress that if someone does not like the idea of a group or just feels they can't commit, because it is a big commitment, it's 2 months, I also can see people individually. So I like that appointment to be a full hour. I help people come up with a quit plan that
How
seems
do people,
most realistic.
For now, them. Now you got to give the nuts and bolts. How do people get in touch? I know you can go to SwedishCovenant.org/quitsmoking.
Yeah, here's the best way. So SwedishCovenant.org/classes. And then the I think the first thing listed right now is the smoking cessation program, because that's starting next week already. Or I'm happy to give out my direct contact information. People can reach me at 312-613-6286, and I'm happy to provide as much information as anyone would want about what my approach is, how to best quit, etc. So
you've led more than, I remember when you were at Northwestern, you've led more than 400, you're pushing 500 groups now with a 50% success rate, and that's pretty remarkable, dear.
I know, I should be rich and famous, Rick, but it's just not.
We all should, sweetie. We all should be rich and famous.
We all should be. But I can't tell you how much I appreciate your support, and that you're still willing to talk about this topic, because
I know,
like I said, it's become a rather pushed aside topic, and it should be front and center.
Yeah, because everybody thinks electric cigarettes are cool looking, and they are so wrong. Come on in here next time you're doing a class. I hope this one is packed.
Thank you.
Roe Coleman, the great producer, put all that information on the website. That's
312. I really appreciate that.
Oh, no, she's great. 613-6286. Carol, it's always great to talk to you, hon.
You as well. And again, thank you so much for your
My
support
pleasure,
for this,
sweetie.
Rick.
Take
and congratulations
care.
To you.
Thanks. Made many people happy. take care.
Okay, you too, Rick.
Take
Bye.
Care. I want to talk to my guest, Steve Sato, is in here. You're coming on soon, aren't you? Getting near that mic. What are you coming on here to talk about? He came in to just visit with his friend Rick.
Take you up on your invitation.
Yeah,
come
sure.
And hang out.
Sure.
In the studio.
It's a cool place to hang out.
It's great. Yeah.
And your lovely wife Amy here too.
Yep. And you have us booked for July 21st.
Talk about John Dillinger.
Yeah, the night before the annual Chicago tradition event, Dillinger Day. July 22nd, and me coming on your show to talk about
We've done it every year for a while.
Yeah, for
how
a
long?
Number of years, like at least 5 years.
Since Dillinger. We've done it so long that Dillinger was on with us. It was before he was here. We said, what, you're going to a movie at the Biograph? What's the matter with you? And we tried to take
don't
him
do
out.
It. Yeah.
We tried to take him out for a drink, and you kept saying, don't do it, John.
Right.
It's too hot outside.
That's right.
It's too hot outside.
That's right.
Well, I always look forward to having you on, and your name and your welcome guests here anytime.
Thank you.
Care to come in. We got to get some commercials in, and then we get to sign off, go home and sleep.